afternoon. I'm really delighted to be talking about and presenting for the first time the outcomes from our pilot study, which is a couples-based intervention, specifically for African-American methamphetamine-involved men in longer-term relationships. To give a little bit of background on how we even got to this sort of couples-based risk reduction for MSM, and even more targeting a population that are African-American, meth-involved, et cetera, I just wanted to point out that this is lodged in a larger trajectory of research, and I'm very fortunate to be surrounded by some very innovative and talented colleagues at the Social Intervention Group at Columbia University. And the real history started with a study called Project Connect, which was a randomized clinical trial of a couples-based intervention for heterosexual couples. And by heterosexual, I really mean mixed gender. I don't mean to imply anything about sexual orientation, but it's just a bit of shorthand that for a mixed gender couple. And the colleagues, the PI on that study, Dr. Nabila El-Bassel, and the rest of us, we were able to show that, yes, indeed, bringing in couples and working in a couples modality was an effective mechanism to enact sexual risk reduction behavior. And those results were published, both short-term results and long-term results, a few years ago. Another sort of offshoot of Project Connect was Project Ebon, which was for, again, heterosexual couples, but in particular it was targeting the overrepresentation or the disproportionate representation of African Americans in the HIV epidemic. And this was a couples-based intervention targeting HIV serodiscordant couples, of which at least one partner was African American. And that was Project Ebon. It was a multi-site study done with the Jamaats in Philadelphia, Gina Wingood and Ralph DiClemente in Atlanta, as well as Gail Wyatt in Los Angeles. And the results from that are just about to come out, so please stay tuned very shortly for hopefully some very exciting results. Some of the conceptual papers have been published in JADES. Another offshoot of the Connect franchise, if you will, is what we call Project Connect 2. And it was really a growth of what we learned from the original Project Connect study. And that was, yes, heterosexual couples, it is effective to intervene by delivering couples-based intervention, but there was a particular subgroup of couples that we felt we could have improved the work. And that was particularly couples where at least one of the members was involved or had to deal with issues of addiction. And so we tweaked the Project Connect intervention a little bit, as well as some of the messages and the drug risk behaviors around HIV transmission, and developed a whole new project called Project Connect 2. And that's also just wrapped up, and we're in the midst of analyzing the data. The preliminary analyses are quite promising, so hopefully next year I'll be standing in front of you or one of my colleagues talking about Project Connect 2 results. And then finally, there's the issue of, as researchers, we do a lot of these studies, and they're under very sort of controlled conditions. What we want to see is, well, once we start to bring things out to the community, what are the mechanisms that facilitate adoption of the standardized, manualized intervention? And so we have a project where the principal investigator is Dr. Susan Witte, called the Dissemination of Connect, where she's looking at the various impacts of various agency characteristics, in particular the use and the advantages of technology, digital technology, in adopting and implementing a structured intervention, in this case Project Connect. So that's sort of the history or the teamwork of the study and this Connect approach or this couples-based approach brings us to this study, working with what I call, for shorthand, African-American methamphetamine-involved MSM couples. And this is to point out that these are couples that I like to say are reside at the nexus of several risk categories. So Dr. Mansour described sort of the elevated risk characteristics of those who are involved in using methamphetamine. I don't think I'll spend too much time, in the interest of time, on the disproportionate representation of African Americans, certainly in the HIV epidemic. And if you went to one of the earlier panel discussions earlier, you'd recognize or you would have heard statistics saying that African Americans were disproportionately represented among syphilis cases, gonorrhea 20-1 versus white men, and chlamydia as well. You might be interested. I see less talk about sort of men in established or longer-term relationships. So I'll spend a little bit of time in here looking at some of the statistics that suggest, or the data that suggest, men in longer-term relationships, or couples, if you will, male couples, that are at elevated risk for HIV transmission. So here's some study that was published by Sanchez and company a few years ago, and they were looking at sort of unprotected sex with main partners versus casual partners, and they broke it down into different sort of categories. They didn't actually present the risk as a function of main partner versus casual partner, so I had to run some of the numbers, and these are all just bivariate unadjusted. But if you run the numbers, you'll see sort of a risk ratio, if you will, that men MSM who are 1.5 times as likely to have unprotected anal sex if that partner is a main versus a casual partner. So using some of the other data in that same report, MSM and longer-term relationships with main partners are about 2.5 times as likely to have unprotected anal sex with an HIV-positive partner if that partner is the main versus casual partner. Actually, this is another study that really sort of started to nail down the importance of looking at MSM in a more established relationship. This is by Sullivan, and this was published last year, looking at the proportion of HIV transmissions among MSM. So these are MSM who are positive, and they can track the transmission source, if you will. And they estimated about 2/3 of the transmissions in the United States of HIV occurred via a main, more established partner. Just coming from the serosorting panel, an interesting kind of bit of data with respect to kind of the potential risk or the danger, if you will, of men in a more established relationship. In that same report, they looked at person who was HIV positive and said, well, what did you think was the HIV status of your main partner? More than 50%, more than half of the cases, the person said, I thought my main partner was HIV negative. Versus a casual partner where that sort of misperception that was still there and still at an important prevalence, but was lower, around the 30% or so level. So I hope that establishes sort of the importance of targeting men in longer-term relationships with another man. So with this study, what we call Connect with Pride, says, well, let's look at those and try to work and target the men at that nexus of risk factors. And the idea is very similar to what Dr. Reback was saying, is the primary aims were to, one, develop, in this case, revise or adapt an existing Connect intervention, but now use it for a new target population, African-American methamphetamine-involved MSM couples, to get some pilot data or preliminary evidence around the potential efficacy or effectiveness of the intervention. And then, if the results are promising, also get some estimates around kind of how can we make larger scale, more rigorous studies more feasible based on kind of our experiences with this study. So how do we formalize or operationalize and select kind of African-American methamphetamine-involved MSM couples? So Dr. Mansur went through some of the main criteria. Here are some of the ones that are unique to our study, and that is men who report having a main partner, someone with whom they've been involved with in a sexual relationship for at least 6 months, and this is actually a common definition for main partner, is a man with whom the participant has an emotional relationship or bond more than any other person. The individual has to identify as African American or Black, or his partner does. Has to report using methamphetamine at least once in the past 60 days, or again, the partner does. In some cases, both were using methamphetamine in the past 60 days. In some cases, only one partner was. And then at least one of the partners had to report engaging in at least one unprotected act of anal intercourse with someone who's not the main partner. So that differs a little bit in that, in some cases, not everyone meets all the criteria, but within this dyad, at least one partner does. And of course, they have to identify each other as their main male partner. So to briefly go over some of the formative work, we also did the qualitative work focus group with 8 couples, where we met with 8 couples over 6 focus groups. And they provided a lot of rich data on sort of the what's going on, the etiological, phenomenological issues around methamphetamine use, relationship dynamics, and particularly the intersection of kind of race, sexual orientation or sexual behavior, and drug use. And also in the interest of time, I won't go in too much detail through sort of a framework that we did to try to distill and understand all the information. Suffice to say, what we wanted to look at is at the multiple levels of influence, from sort of personal level factors to interpersonal or sort of dyadic level factors, to more what I want to touch on briefly, or I feel is worth touching on, is sort of what we call the macro level factors. And in particular, what we wanted to address was sort of the intersection of aspects of race, sexual orientation, or sexuality, and in particular, what happens when there's sort of an intersection or overlap among these issues, particularly since these are oppressed or minority or marginalized populations. So in particular, with respect to kind of some of these larger issues, or being sure we touched on this, we employed what's sort of an anti-racist perspective with respect to race. And the idea here is to recognize a couple things. One is that we don't want to presume sort of or ignore or overlook and sort of be a little bit too Pollyanna-ish around the aspect of race. So we don't want to say everybody's equal, aren't we all humans, there's only one race, the human race. That feels a little too superficial. And the other is, hopefully many of you are critical of me standing in front of you and saying, well, who's this Wu guy who's going to work with African Americans? What gives him the knowledge, the know-how, even the right, especially in the context of the history of how researchers have treated African Americans in the past? And so what we want to do is put those issues on the table, be upfront. I'm not an expert in African American kind of culture or working with African Americans. Even if I was, the experience of participants coming in would be a little bit skeptical at first. And so we want to put that on the table and be upfront about that and say, what we want to do is, how can we work with you so that you tell me your reality? You tell me the impact of being a racial or ethnic minority. And so that's how we come to this anti-racist paradigm. It has some kind of threads of cultural humility in that, again, it's about sort of the construction, the worldview, and the experience, and being open about it, but it also looks at the aspects of power and recognizes that there are dominant forces of society, and there are aspects of power and being marginalized and oppressed that really play a part in behavior and our ability to get services, reach services, and the impact of being in a research study as well. It also says we don't want to impose an anti-racist ideology is also contrasting to imposing, say, the Afrocentric paradigm or a one sort of cultural paradigm that we think will apply for everyone. Because in the qualitative work, what we found was for African-American MSM, sometimes they related well to, say, the African-American community or their families of origin or the church. But other members, other individuals, other participants really felt disenfranchised, felt very stigmatized, very marginalized by some of these very structures. And again, so instead of trying to fight through and break through and impose a unifying structure, we said, let's start with where you're at and your experience. If you want to kind of follow an Afrocentric paradigm and follow the principles of Nguzo Saba, we'll be there with you. If you really have a strong reaction and feel the founder is misogynistic and homophobic, we're with you. And then we'll work on that as a strength, your ability to think critically. And so we do the same thing, of course, not only with race, but with sexual orientation or sexual behavior and sexuality, recognizing the different sexualities or sexual orientations and stated and self-identified sexual orientations, particularly among African-American MSM. So all that to say, this is how we sort of analyzed the qualitative data, or the framework with which we came in. We also worked with different community constituents, from service providers to having a community advisory board and a program review panel. Ultimately, we came up with a standardized intervention or manualized intervention, which allows our facilitators kind of a quick overview of every session, what each session, the targets, if you will, and the objectives of each session are. Some of the materials that are needed to help prep them, and then just the activities and ways to interact and suggested helpful hints in working with the participants. There is a strong theoretical framework informing this. It's social cognitive theory. I won't bore you to tears with this. Many of you are probably more expert in social cognitive theory than I am. Just to point out that in orange are some of the couple specific aspects of the theoretical framework. So our pilot test is very similar to what Dr. Reback presented, so fortunately I can go through this very quickly. It's a pre-post test where we went and recruited in several ways. One way was sort of standard sort of outreach in bars and clubs. We had our palm card with our logo on one side and some contact information on the other. We also created a community group, a venue, if you will, for men to just come and socialize, a safe space, if you will, what we call chat and chew. It was not about HIV risk reduction. It was just about bringing African-American men in same-sex relationships together to value and to put forth a safe space for African-American men in same-sex relationships to congregate and talk. Oftentimes, folks would ask about the study and refer others from that venue, but it was really about a safe space. We employed an ACASI. This is not actually one of our participants. This is just what I copied from Google Image. But the ACASI for the baseline test, ACASI audio computer assisted self-interview. We delivered the intervention, which was typically held weekly. Some participants or couples went through it twice a week. For each of the seven sessions. Each session lasted about 90 minutes, and both members of a couple had to be there to receive the intervention. So it was a couples-based intervention. And then 2 months later, we did our post-test, ACASI, again. So we had about 5 or so months of recruitment. We enrolled 34 couples, or 68 individuals. Among those 34 couples, we had about 4/5 of them attend all 7 intervention sessions. Which meets or exceeds a lot of the other couples-based HIV studies. Many of them have fewer sessions than we did. And then we're able to reach 96% of our couple individuals completed the follow-up assessment. And we had representation from every couple. Our measures for the primary outcomes, the sexual risk measures, were the number of male sexual partners reported by each individual, the number of episodes of unprotected anal intercourse with the main partner. We combined both receptive and insertive anal intercourse for primarily for statistical issues, which I'm happy to explain in the question and answer session. And if a couple had broken up, we also use a replacement main partner at follow-up, as well as a proportion of episodes of anal intercourse with a main partner for which a condom was used. So that's what I'll often just refer to as a proportion of protected episodes of anal intercourse. We're also interested in the drug use outcomes. So we had a frequency scale that measured both meth use as well as a bunch of different types of illicit drugs. And so we just took the average reports of frequency across all the drugs that were used, and then the number of different types of illicit drugs that were used. And so the latter two are sort of more global measures of drug involvement. And we're a little less, at least at this point, targeting specific drugs, and just more sort of global overall measures of drug involvement. So in the interest of time, I'll skip some of the statistical issues. Just remember that we were working with couples and we had to sort of look at the non-independence due to sort of folks reporting about behavior often between each other. So they're not sort of independent measures. So essentially what we did was use generalized linear mixed models to account for that. And then to sort of test for a change over time, you look at the coefficient for the time element or variable in the generalized linear mixed model. And we did that both for sexual risk and drug use outcomes. On average, here are the socio-demographics of our participants. The mean age was around 41. I will point out that not everyone was African-American. About 9/10, or we had 6 folks who are not African-American, but they were in a relationship with someone who was African-American. We had the majority of our sample was HIV positive. And since not everyone had to be a meth user in the study, I wanted to put up this slide that showed 3/4 of the men had used meth in the past 2 months, which meant about 1/2 of the couples, both partners were meth users, and about 1/2 of the couples, only one of the partners was meth using. So here are pre-post results. The baseline is shown here, the average number of sexual partners in the black bar on the left, and follow up the average number of sexual partners in the cyan bar on the right. And we see a drop on average from an average of 4.5 to 1.6 at follow up. For the number of unprotected acts of anal intercourse with a main partner, at baseline was a little over 13, and at follow-up it dropped down to 2. And for proportion of acts that were protected, it started at around 18%. At follow-up, it was 72%. We could show you the statistical significance at a bivariate level, except we wouldn't have controlled for sort of the partner effects, and that's why I didn't sort of want to report p-values here. Without that correction, these are statistically significant, but just wanted to take you more to the fancier model that can account for the couples. So shown here are the results in the generalized linear mixed model. Here I'll just draw your attention to the time statistic, and indeed it shows in this model we were able to infer that there was a significant reduction in the number of sexual partners moving from baseline to follow-up among our participants after controlling for both the couples nesting as well as some of the socio-demographics. We also saw similarly significant reductions in the number of unprotected acts of anal intercourse, as well as an increase in the proportion of acts of anal intercourse with a main partner for which a condom was used. And again, these are all significant. Similar with respect to drug use, in the last minute I'll wrap up, we saw a decrease in the use of the frequency of methamphetamine use. These, just for your reference, this is the scale, so these aren't sort of real number units, so with reference to this frequency scale, but at higher numbers indicates more frequent use. And we saw a drop from baseline to follow-up, both on meth use frequency as well as the average frequency of use of any illicit drug from baseline to follow-up. And then also a decrease in the number of types of illicit drugs used. So running the full statistical models, we do see a statistically significant decrease in methamphetamine use frequency among our participants, as well as the average use of any illicit drugs. And we see a statistically significant decline in the number of different types of illicit drugs used among our participants. So all told, what did we learn from this? So we'd say, based on these results, the significant findings in reduction of risk with the sexual risk measures, as well as methamphetamine and drug use measures, we do feel that this connect with pride intervention has shown or demonstrated promise in reducing those behaviors. I didn't give you any information, but we had no adverse events. And the high attention and retention rates we felt demonstrated as feasibility. In the question and answer session, I'd be happy to talk about some of the other lessons that we learned about this intervention in the conduct of this intervention. But I will point out some of the next steps. We're going to continue to disseminate some of the findings and continue to do some more analyses, probably some of the ones that you're going to hear about from my fellow and sister principal investigators on this cooperative agreement. And then, of course, a larger scale study designed to kind of target all the limitations that are inherent in the small scale pilot study that we've described. So with that, I would like to finish up thanking some very key players, Dr. Robert Remian, who is a consultant on the study, Yves-Michel Fontaine, who is a project director during the formative work for which much of this laid the foundation for much of this work, Wayne Johnson and Ilya Teplinsky at the CDC and CDC for funding this study. Other important folks at our site were Dale Frett and Jordan White, who helped deliver and recruit the intervention, our community collaborators and colleagues, and absolutely, of course, the participants who generated or donated a generous amount of time, energy, and effort and enthusiasm for the study. So with that, thank you very much.
Thanks. All right, thanks so much. So with your review, are you viewing a relationship as a high-risk behavior?
The question is the relationship itself a high-risk behavior? And I would say the answer to that is the same as I would say, is inherently being African-American put you at risk? And I would say inherently no. However, it comes along with the social and structural environment and the world in which we operate often elevates the risk. And so another thing I like to say is, again, with respect to, say, African American, the HIV virus can't see the color of your skin, right? It doesn't see facial features of the phenotype of race, right? What it sees is, or what it encounters and explains that disproportionate representation or cases of HIV transmission are things like higher risk sexual networks, low rates of testing. That's what explains the higher rates. And it's the same thing with the relationships. It's not the relationship itself, it's the social, structural, and the environment within which relationships are formed, maintained, or as in our qualitative work, particularly with African-American MSM, the isolation that can often occur and the withdrawal from various communities that often occurs in a relationship. So relationship in and of itself, no. The sort of social and societal factors in which a relationship is formed and maintained, I would say that's truly what predicts the risk, or is the risk.
The point of interest, the time from the beginning of the relationship to the point of disclosure of HIV status, that always tends to show quite telling, like at what point does conversation begin versus trying to begin conversation upon late disclosure.
I think disclosure and the aspect of safer sex and risk reduction, I think is a very telling and important dynamic that this intervention is really designed, and some of our activities are around the process of enacting safer sex behavior as X, Y, and Z are disclosed or found out or worked on between partners. So a very good point. I like that.
Okay, thanks, Owen.